You may be seated. We are here on case 2014-1377. Before we begin with the appellant, Ms. Wood, I would like to note that Judge Carla Moore from the 9th District is sitting in place of Justice O'Neill. Welcome, Judge Moore.
Thank you.
Ms. Wood.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Carrie Wood, and I represent the appellant Tyrone Noling. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. Under 295373E, the statute at issue in this case, an applicant who is sentenced to...
Counsel, could you maybe adjust the microphone so we can hear you?
Yes, sure. Is that better?
Okay. Yes, thanks.
You're welcome. Under the statute, an applicant who is sentenced to probation receives more protection to ensure appropriate access to post-conviction DNA testing than someone who is sentenced to death. Ohio's post-conviction DNA statute was enacted to ensure appropriate access to post-conviction DNA testing and to potentially identify wrongfully convicted people in the state of Ohio. In order to ensure appropriate access to this post-conviction DNA testing, the legislature provided non-capital defendants a mandatory merit review. That review has proved important because in approximately 34% of appeals, that trial court's decision has been reversed. In addition, now all 50 states have a statute that provides access to post-conviction DNA testing. In approximately only two states, either by rule or by statute, only two states don't provide some sort of review of a trial court's decision. So in other words, review of a trial court's decision is necessary to vindicate the rights provided under the statute.
The problem that you see here is that there can be a denial by the trial court, and then currently it would be a petition to the Supreme Court for review, and if the Supreme Court did not take it in, that's the end of the story. And that's what you find objectionable, right?
That's correct, in part. What is objectionable is that for instance, under the statute, someone who's sentenced to probation gets a mandatory merit review looking for individual errors in that probationer's case. However, someone who's sentenced to death can only ask this court to look at broad questions of law that have impact beyond his case and not individual errors that occurred in his case. That's the objectionable portion of 295373E.
Are we that constrained? Are we that limited?
Yes, Your Honor. What the statute has written is that Mr. Noling or any capital defendant whose appeal is or whose application is denied in the trial court only gets to ask this court for discretionary review. That's what the statute says. And the Constitution, as well as this court's rules, specifically constrain this court's jurisdiction on a discretionary review. So for instance, in Mr. Noling's case, there were—
But in death cases, the citizens of Ohio took out the intermediate appeal, and it's everything comes directly here. So. We get to look at everything, do we not, on the merit appeals?
On the direct appeal, yes.
And it's automatic and it's a right. We don't get to decline to take those.
That's correct.
Right. But on this, because we could decline to take it, that's the constitutional rub.
Yes, that's unconstitutional under both the Equal Protection Clause as well as the Due Process Clause. The United States Supreme Court has said that once you put an appellate process in place, it has to comport with both equal protection as well as due process. So looking at equal protection, you have to look at who are the class of people. And the class of people in this particular case are people whose applications for DNA testing have been
denied.
Could
that be cured? If the legislature said, okay, if it's a death case, then these issues go directly to the Supreme Court, not to the Court of Appeals, as the basic appeal does. The Supreme Court has to take them, and the Supreme Court can look at all the issues that an appellate court would ordinarily be allowed to review.
Yes, that would cure the constitutional errors in this particular case. It's not the deprivation of the intermediate appellate court. What it is the deprivation of a merit review for individual errors in Mr. Noling's case, as well as all other capital defendants.
But counsel, right now, review is of the decision with regard to testing the DNA, correct?
The merit review is of, there are a number of errors that Mr. Noling raised, and it would be the review of the decision for denying testing, as well as a number of the other errors that relate to that particular decision, yes.
But in this case, counsel, Mr. Noling had review of the denial of DNA testing as it relates to the cigarette butt, correct?
No, the cigarette butt was in fact tested. There's been no merit or individualized review for the entirety of Mr. Noling's application.
That's my point. He did have the testing as it relates to that. So what we're looking at now relates to the shell casings and the jewelry box.
Yes, the errors or the testing that Mr. Noling is seeking relates to the shell casings from the murder weapon, as well as the ring boxes that were opened by the perpetrator. In addition to the DNA testing, Mr. Noling also sought from the trial court to have the shell casings from the murder weapon run through the database. In addition, Mr. Noling also sought the actual results of the testing from the cigarette butt. That was additionally one of the assignment of errors that at least two justices of this court actually voted to take on jurisdictional review. So there are a number of things that still haven't been reviewed by a court of appeals for error in Mr. Noling's case.
And how do you relate that to the arbitrary imposition of capital punishment?
The arbitrariness goes to the due process clause, and the arbitrariness of capital punishment. I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question. When we're looking at DNA testing, and I think the statistic is that of the now well over 300 DNA exonerations, I believe it's 10 are capital defendants. And so a denial of DNA testing would at least result in some arbitrariness in the imposition of the death penalty.
But what is a remedy that you're asking the court then to consider if the court agrees with your position?
Would ask the court to remand the case to the 11th District Court of Appeals for an individualized merit review, which is provided to all non-capital defendants.
And Justice Pfeiffer points out that the Constitution says death penalty reviews come here. So what is our vehicle to do that?
But this, although the cases do come here, this court held in Davis that in post-conviction judgments, they can still go to the Intermediate Court of Appeals.
So are you looking for a judicial determination that henceforth DNA review is to be filed with the appellate courts, and that is their responsibility to consider those matters in all capital cases? Is that, am I understanding your argument correctly?
I think that's probably a little broader than what I'm asking the court for. What I'm asking the court for is to remove the portion of the statute that only gets to the discretionary, that only allows a discretionary appeal. Unfortunately, in that particular process,
so you're looking for a declaration that the portion of the statute that grants discretionary review with this court to be held to be unconstitutional.
Yes.
And remand all those matters to the appellate courts.
Yes.
Although, counsel, could we not, instead of doing that, if we were to find the statute unconstitutional under 2953.73(e)(1), which it talks about if the offender was sentenced to death, if we were to reject or delete the words "may seek leave of" and just say the offender may appeal the rejection to the Supreme Court, it would be the same as 2, which says if they're not sentenced to death, they may appeal to the Court of Appeals.
I think
would put the parties on an equal basis, would it not?
I think the only troubling word there, Your Honor, is may.
Getting rid of the word may would be another way to correct the statute if we find it's unconstitutional.
If the court saw a way to write 2953-73E to give mandatory review as it does in Smith and direct appeals to this court, then that would, as I believe I stated earlier, would be constitutionally permissible.
You're saying the word may is a problem? The word may is in subsection 2 as well, where it talks about the offender who was not sentenced to death. If the rejection is a final appealable order, and the offender may appeal to the Court of Appeals.
What would you replace it with if you don't have may?
I would just simply, for clarity purposes, take the language that through issue 1 that's in 2BC, and just to make it clear that it was, just like in direct appeals, a mandatory merit review to this court. But if the court, for clarity purposes, just to make sure that there is no discussion later about, well, this is still a discretionary review.
Well, but the may relates to the activity that the offender will do. You cannot, and the legislature did not, put in the word shall, because obviously they have seek leave of the Supreme Court. And we could not, if you're advocating that we strike some language, sever, as opposed to, in order to fix this problem, we can't insert a word, we can only sever.
Right.
So it would read, the offender may appeal the rejection to the Supreme Court. That's the onus then on the offender to take whatever legal course of action, correct?
Yes.
So why is that not satisfactory?
That would probably be satisfactory. The word may, just as a general matter, I just want to make sure, my only concern is discretion, removing the discretionary piece, and that there would be a mandatory merit review. That is my only concern.
But I agree with the court. You've got 2 choices here. If we strike the whole thing, mm-hmm. Then it's up to the legislature to fix. If we sever, you get a quicker result, and there's no guarantee that the legislature is going to see things, any differently, and how they would then reconstruct this statute.
If this court seeks to only sever, not do the severance that I proposed in the briefs, but sever and keep and do a merit review for Mr. Noling, that would be constitutionally adequate, Your Honor.
Okay, but this relates to the DNA testing.
That's correct.
But that's not your whole problem with review, is it? I mean, yes, in this particular case, it is the DNA testing, but you brought up the issue of the fact that other issues on post-conviction don't go to the appellate court, but are discretionarily presented to the Supreme Court. I thought I heard you say that in the answer to my first question.
Some issue, I'm sorry, Your Honor, could you clarify what you're asking me now?
Well, this statute that we're talking about, 2953-73-E1, involves DNA testing.
That's correct.
And you would be satisfied if this court would excise certain words in there, and that's what you're asking for at this point?
Yes.
Okay.
In the interest of wrapping up as much as possible, is this case in a posture where if we did the modification that's just been discussed, could we go on and say, go ahead and do the testing that's requested, or is that another case for another day?
If this court, and I'm sure the state would probably agree with me, that if this court decided to do a merit review, to excise that portion of the statute and do a merit review, I'm sure briefing would be the next step. But yes, in the end, this court could certainly, if they took, if it took jurisdiction and reviewed the merits, you could certainly order DNA testing in this case.
Counsel, your friends at the state, your friends at the state say, in terms of rational basis review, that there is a basis for differentiating between the capital defendants and the non-capital mm-hmm. defendants. So if we can kind of take a
sure,
couple of steps back,
yes,
can you talk
absolutely.
About what? Why would you disagree with that? Why do you say that there is no rational basis for differentiating?
The state proffers a few reasons why there is a rational basis, and I think the most likely their leading cause is delay. And that's why the legislature tried to write in Smith had sort of eliminated the intermediate review. But post-conviction DNA testing is different. Post-conviction DNA testing is not a reason to either delay setting a date of execution or carrying out an execution itself. It's not a collateral attack on the conviction. It's simply, I think, as many appellate courts have pointed out, even success in a DNA application does not ensure, it just ensures getting testing. Testing can be inconclusive. In fact, in Mr. Bunnell's case, who's another death penalty inmate, testing in fact implicated him in the crime. So certainly DNA testing is not something that would delay. In fact, in Mr. Noling's case, I think the two disparate tracks has actually extended the right now in, because there's a new trial motion in the Intermediate Court of Appeals that has previously been on hold for the DNA portion, which goes up and down to a different appellate track. But there really is no rational basis. The merit review, when we're talking about looking for errors in an individual case and whether or not we want to give force and effect to Ohio's post-conviction DNA testing statute, mandatory merit review is what does it, not a discretionary review. The lower court cases, the Intermediate Court of Appeals cases, bear that out.
Thank you.
Thank you. You've used your time.
Sure.
Mr. Viglucci.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, Associate Justices. It was 27 years ago when Tyrone Noling murdered Cora and Bernhard Hartig in their kitchen. I've stood before this court three times now on this case, arguing various aspects. This is the second time I've been before this court on this particular statute, this particular subdivision of the statute, on the issue of constitutionality of this statute. The court found in 2013 that the statute was constitutional.
But the argument was not equal protection, was it, at that time?
Well, it was, yes. If it,
specifically?
The case was taken in on statutory grounds, and the court asked us to brief the issue of constitutionality in light of Davis. And in the opinion as written, Judge O'Donnell, in a dissent with Judge French, did raise constitutionality, did raise due process, did raise equal protection, and the court, in its majority opinion, rejected those analyses and cited State v. Smith in its rejection. So I submit that this court has looked at this before, has looked at due process and equal protection, and here we are again today. The court found in Noling 2, which I'll refer to as the last time I was here, that the legislature did properly and can, within its power, restrict the Court of Appeals jurisdiction, and that this court could properly hear appeals from 295373E. The legislature, Your Honors, in crafting this statute, looked long and hard at constitutionality. It's not something that they skipped over or glossed over. When this was passed in 2003, the legislature initially contemplated permitting no appeals from this, which would have been in their power to do. No court, state, any state, or federal, has extended constitutional protections to PCR, post-conviction collateral attacks, to convicted felons. No court, ever. The appellant is asking this court to take a tremendous leap and go where no court has gone before in extending constitutional protections to post-conviction procedures. So the legislature crafted this with due regard to issue one, that is the rational basis of expediting these appeals, of not permitting endless requests for DNA. This case is the poster child for that. This is the third request for DNA from this defendant. And here I am again in the Supreme Court, 27 years after the murder.
But counsel, position of the appellant here is that what they're asking for is provided to other convicted defendants or felons and not available to a death penalty defendant.
The precise track of the appeal, that's true, Your Honor, and there's no requirement that it be so.
Because it's post-conviction.
Because it's post-conviction.
Because they have a direct appeal to the Supreme Court on the merits of a direct appeal.
That's where due process and equal protection come in. The Constitution says that they're entitled to a fair trial and one direct appeal. I mean, that's when we talk about free lawyers and transcripts and equal protection and due process.
But what about the reality that oftentimes this testing, this DNA testing, has exonerated people on death row? What about the trend, I would say, in the legal circles is that because death is different and because you don't want to leave any stone unturned, that you do afford this extra layer? I mean, philosophically, how would you look at that?
That hasn't been the case law in dealing with capital versus non-capital defendants. They are not a suspect class. They are not entitled to more due process or equal protection after the conviction. And in Ohio, the appeal to this court, it's incorrect to say that there is no review for a capital defendant's DNA. There's only been three cases, Your Honor, since 2003, when this statute was enacted, that have come to this court. Only nine capital defendants have sought DNA testing to the trial courts. And of those, only three came to this court, ours being one of them, and two others in 13 years.
Let me ask you, is the one that stayed in the trial court, you say three and there was nine, so the six, was the DNA offer confirmation in those cases inconclusive, or did they exonerate?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor.
Okay.
I know the answer to the three that attempted to come here, but I don't know for all nine.
Okay.
But whatever those nine, they did not seek
so
to come
it's
before
this
court.
This case is one of the three, right?
Correct.
Twice. Prayed is another one.
No.
That was not on DNA?
It's not a capital.
It's not a capital.
Not a capital case. All right.
I said, I'm sorry, capital cases, Your Honor. What I was saying is that even in the review that comes to this court, the record below is transmitted up here. The record contains transcripts of what happened below. It is reviewed by this court, and I've got to believe that the court and your clerks upstairs aren't throwing dice to determine which cases come before it. So there is some review of what's happening in this case. This court is familiar with these cases because it heard the direct appeal. And after Noling 2, wherein this court stated that it had concurrent jurisdiction to hear these direct appeals, the court is not limited to finding some great constitutional question or issue of great public interest.
Well, I guess that's what I thought as well, that we, once it's here and it's a death case, there are no limits on what we can examine or review.
In fact, the appellate rule 7.01b1 allows the court to take in a case involving death penalty post-conviction appeals. That's what it says.
Let me ask, while it's not part of the what we're here to decide today, isn't there a dispute as to whether or not whatever exists with respect to these casings is compromised to the point that it has no value? So
untestable.
We're having an argument about something that leads nowhere.
Correct, Your Honor. We're here because it's going to cause another year or two delay in executing Mr. Noling. The BCI lab was very clear that these casings back in 1990 were handled by many police officers. In fact, one of them wrote a magic marker on the casings. They are so far contaminated that they are untestable.
They're untestable for fingerprints or any other DNA testing.
Right, for touch DNA, for any type of DNA.
Did they do a ballistics analysis on these? Isn't that one of the things that they're asking for, is to the shell casings to be examined in maybe CODIS?
Well, that's not DNA, and
I know that's
come
not
under this.
But
is
that something? Did I read that they're asking for that as well?
I believe so.
Okay.
Yeah.
But counsel, when you look at Noling 2, paragraph 28, the majority specifically said that although we appeared to, there appeared to be constitutional questions and equal protection, it was not raised by the parties. That's what paragraph 28 said. And now we're being asked to look at E1 with the specificity of E1, section 1 and section 2, where capital defendants may get appeal only with the discretion of the court, and non-capital defendants have the automatic right to appeal to the Court of Appeals. That's where the equal protection argument is being put before us for the first time.
The rest of paragraph 28, Your Honor, refers to the dissent and rebuts that by saying that this court had previously ruled this statute constitutional,
well,
citing Smith.
We were looking in Smith. We were looking at the overall tracks, the one track for the Court of Appeals and the one track for the Supreme Court. So we weren't talking about the specificity that we have here.
Not to belabor the point, Your Honor, you did look at Justice O'Donnell's dissent, which specifically argued equal protection and due process.
That's not the same as saying it in the majority, that this is what we're holding. But the question that I have is looking at 1 and 2 and the argument of, or the question about, if we were to find the statute unconstitutional for equal protection reasons, could the deletion of seek leave of the Supreme Court to, getting rid of that language, where you would make it synonymous with 2 and say the rejection could be appealed to the Supreme Court. Would that resolve the problem, in your view?
Your Honor, first of all, I don't think the court can or should go there. It's not a constitutional question for this court to take up. As I said previously, no court, state or federal, has ever extended this type of constitutional analysis to a convicted defendant who chooses to take a civil collateral attack to his or her conviction. This is not with under the umbrella of the Constitution or equal protection or due process.
Has any state treated felons different from capital defendants the way Ohio has in affording DNA review for post-conviction to felons but not to capital defendants, to your knowledge?
Massachusetts, Your Honor, there's a case cited, and I can't remember the exact citation to it. There's a Massachusetts court, Supreme Court, that did that.
Okay.
Yes, and it was held in the federal courts to be constitutional.
Okay, so the disparate treatment between felons and capital defendants has been affirmed, did you say?
In a Massachusetts court.
Okay.
And in a federal court.
Was that a federal district or was it a circuit court, or do you know?
I don't know.
We'll
it's in our brief.
Was it passed on by the Massachusetts Supreme Court, to your
yes,
knowledge?
Yes, it was.
Okay.
And I think the AG in its amicus brief also cites to it.
Okay, and other than Massachusetts and Ohio, you're not aware of this coming up elsewhere?
No.
All right.
And if it has, the courts have declined to extend this type of constitutional protection to a post-conviction collateral attack.
Okay. How extensive is this problem?
It's not.
You said it's come up here
three times in 13 years.
Okay. So this is not a pervasive problem.
No,
here.
And the other side of the coin is it's not a great burden on this court when it's asked to review, to make a review in determining whether to take it in or not. As I said, you have the whole record in front of you. You've heard the merit decision directly. You're the court most familiar with the case. You're the court most able to compare it to other capital cases since you've heard them all. And three times in 13 years, I know this court would take the time to give a good look at it. And in that decision, exercising its discretion whether to take it in or not, this also prevents, or should theoretically prevent, continuous DNA appeals, which go against the will of the people of this state as expressed in Issue 1 and this constitutional changes and statutory changes which came from Issue 1, that these capital cases be expedited, that we're not standing here 27 years after the crime. We're not telling the people of the state of Ohio that they should not have faith in their criminal justice system, that the judgments of the courts and the juries are meaningless, that they have to be given effect at some point.
Counsel, why would it be objectionable, and I just heard everything you said about this court knowing, et cetera, and if we're not, if the recommendation here is to strike the language, seek leave of the Supreme Court too, and you excise that language, and then you make the DNA appeal similar to the direct appeal rights, and I know that you're against that because of the civil nature and the collateral attack, et cetera, but if the court does strike those words and then it becomes an automatic appeal, provided the defendant does appeal to the Supreme Court, what's the downside of doing that?
You're infringing on the legislative function.
Well, we do that with excising statutes, not frequently, but that's our job sometimes.
Well, only when there is proof beyond a reasonable doubt that the legislature has overstepped its bounds and has created something that is unconstitutional. Otherwise, this court would be legislating. The legislature, as I said, looked at this very carefully.
And you say that we're precluded from finding this to be unconstitutional based on our record in Smith, probably Davis, and our sister states across the country, Massachusetts, et cetera. And you say in Noling too.
Yes. I'm saying this court would take a tremendous leap. And when you made that excise, you would have to say that there were constitutional grounds to do so, that the legislature overstepped its authority as given by the people of the state of Ohio when it created these statutes as a result of the constitutional change, and that the state legislature in its deliberations had somehow run afoul of the Constitution. I don't think that's the case. I think they had every right. They could have afforded no appeal here.
But isn't that the point? I mean, the real issue is Section 2, where you say for non-capital cases, anyone who has a rejection of a DNA request has the right to a merit appeal to the Court of Appeals. And so the question is, why shouldn't that be given in cases where we have the capital defendant?
Because to do so, you would have to find that the legislation ran afoul of the Constitution, that there was an equal protection violation.
That's the question.
What
is the distinction? What is the rational distinction in this particular situation between the two?
There is no fundamental right of a capital defendant to PCR DNA review. So there's no fundamental right.
And the same is true for a non-capital, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
Capital defendants are not a suspect class under equal protection.
And neither are non-capital felons.
That's correct. And I guess the real difference is that they are not similarly situated.
Right. The one faces the death penalty, the other doesn't.
Well, this court spent two or three pages in the Smith decision explaining why capital defendants and non-capital defendants were not similarly situated. And it wasn't just that issue. There are a number of issues that make them not similarly situated. Therefore, the legislature can treat them differently.
But in the Smith case, we were talking about the two parallel paths. We weren't talking about no right to appeal.
The similarly situated argument applies in either review. They are not similarly situated where they must be given identical paths of appeal.
Is your point that the ultimate review is a discretionary review with the Ohio Supreme Court in either case, capital defendants and non-capital defendants, and this court has a discretionary review over both, and it's a direct appeal by virtue of the statute to this court in capital cases, and an indirect review through the Court of Appeals in the non-capital case? Is that your argument?
Are we talking just the DNA portion?
Yes.
Yes, the non-capital have a appeal to the appellate court, and then a court
which
discretionary.
Which has to take their appeal. It's not discretionary with the appellate court. And
correct.
I think that's the crux of the appellant's argument here, is that a non-capital defendant is afforded an appellate review that is not discretionary. The appellate court has to do that. In a capital case, they do get a bite at the apple, so to speak, of appellate review. It's the Supreme Court, but it's discretionary. In other words, we don't have to take it. And I think that is the crux of the disparate treatment.
Again, your analysis, Chief Justice, is a constitutional analysis. And I'll say again that there is no constitutional rights here. Secondly, your presumption is that the discretionary review to this court is no review. And I dispute that. And I think the court knows that as these cases come in, it must transmit the record. It must bring the record below and the transcripts up, that you do give it a thorough look, that yourselves and your clerks are familiar with the case, and that it's improper to say that you're rejecting these things willy-nilly. That's not happening.
And to go back to, maybe I didn't fully comprehend it, did you tell us that there were nine such appeals and we took three?
Nine capital defendants since 2003 have attempted
to
DNA.
To come here?
No, filed with the trial courts. Request
okay.
for
how
DNA
many
testing.
Attempted to come here that we
three.
didn't take?
Two of the three.
We took one and did not take two.
Did not take two. And one of those two was mooted out because the testing was done.
And did the other one that we didn't take, go to federal court on that issue?
No, I think the issue there was, much like here, that the parent sample was inadequate for testing. So, you know, when that happens, you're pretty much done everywhere. When the parent sample is inadequate, then you're done.
And you're saying that's what's the case in Noling now?
Now it is, yes. And the trial court has so found, and you did not take in those assignments of error dealing with that, because I think that is moot, but you took only the constitutional question again, so that's why we're here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, you used your time. You may take a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. The one point I would like to make is that the state has argued that it would be a leap for this court to extend due process and equal protection to the process provided under the DNA testing statute. That is not correct. This court has extended equal protection to judicial release statutes, and the United States Supreme Court has provided both equal protection and due process protections to civil cases, as well as eviction. We're talking about termination of parental rights. So the question is, once the state gives a process under the statute, it must comport with due process.
Procedure. I thought Mr. Buglisi argued that no state has extended post-conviction DNR to this level. He said there is no protection. If I understood his argument correctly, I think there's a collateral attack through the DNA. Mm-hmm. He said no state has done this.
The DNA is not a collateral attack. It's just a civil process. It's not a collateral attack on the conviction.
Is it moot because there isn't a sample to be tested?
That's correct. That's not correct. We would disagree with that. There has been no scientific testing to show that there's no DNA there.
But that's not the reason that it's, I mean, if it's contaminated, it's because of the way it's been handled and processed that there's no ability to be, it's not a pristine sample because of the handling by whomever in the last umpteen years.
Quantity and quality determinations under the statute, those are scientific terms and must be determined by scientific testing. Even if there is some contamination of those shell casings, if the same DNA profile is on the cigarette butt and on the shell casings, even though another profile might also be present on the shell casings, the only person that would have touched that cigarette butt and touched those shell casings is the person who killed the Hardigs. That is the DNA testing that we are asking for under the statute, and we need review in order to ask those questions of a reviewing court, and that's what we're asking this court
to
do.
And you think there's a constitutional right to this discretionary review? Is that what you're saying?
There is a procedural due process requires that the appellate process not be arbitrarily denied, and it be sufficient to vindicate the rights provided. That's what procedural due process requires, and that's what we're asking
for. What about the point that was discussed when Mr. Figlucci was at the podium, that our review as a court, when the appeal is made to us, is a review of whether it's a determination of whether or not we will take the case in, but it does afford the defendant who is motioning to have the DNA review. We do review what happened in the trial court with regard to that topic, the DNA review.
This court has described the difference between the merit review process and its jurisdictional review. And the court has described the merit review process in the Intermediate Court of Appeals as looking at individual rights and errors, and only looking at, with respect to discretionary reviews, that it's a broad question. Certainly there can be individual errors in a case that this court doesn't believe is a broad question of law, that it comes within its constitutionally prescribed jurisdiction. Well,
what case are you referring to when you say we have said that?
And I'm sorry, Your Honor. I just, it is now presently escaping me. But I would also say that that is, you know, it's prescribed within the Ohio Constitution. When you're looking at discretionary review, you're talking
about.
But
we do take into consideration when we're determining whether to take a case in, whether there's a constitutional question at stake here, in addition to great general and public interest and some of the other criteria that, quite frankly, there's seven members up here, and I'm not so sure we're always on the same page in what we take in, but nonetheless, there is a thorough review done. I can, you know, assure you of that. So if there is a request that we take it in because this is a constitutional issue, you can rest assured that it is reviewed under that context.
And I think one of the things that Mr. Vellucci mentioned, that the record is transmitted. Well, when this court is deciding the jurisdictional question, and there was expert testimony that was in, you know, that was in the trial court in this case, that transcript, when this court is deciding the jurisdictional question, this court didn't have the expert transcript. That's not how the discretionary review process works.
Counsel, that's correct, but I'm not sure that, well, I'm pretty sure it's not fair or correct to characterize the general standards that we apply to which cases we select on a jurisdictional basis, to apply that to death cases. I think the individual members of this court, when it's a death case, are willing to go the extra mile and then some in terms of giving the defendants the opportunity to have any credible argument presented and reviewed by this court. So our individual analysis on whether or not to take a case is much different when we're looking at a pro se brief from a criminal on a garden variety claim than it is when we're looking at a death case. I think that would be obvious to every prosecutor and every defense practitioner in death cases.
And I think because death is different, the court should, the lower errors, the other errors that this court did not take up in this case and is not going to issue an opinion on, are certainly important errors that should be addressed. And with respect to the getting of the actual results in the case, at least two members of the court thought it was important enough to review. And so I understand the court's position that in death cases, perhaps this court's review is more, provides more scrutiny. But what we're asking for is the same merit review that all non-capital defendants get. Because once those cases, maybe they look superficial at the beginning, once you get into the record, which would only happen if you took up the case, perhaps there's something once you review the expert testimony that is troubling to the court. And so we're simply asking for that same merit review that's provided non-capital defendants, where the error rate, which is a constitutional consideration, is at least 34%. 34% error rate is troubling when we're talking about sentencing someone to death.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you adjourn court?
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.